During the years I worked for Friends United Meeting, I had the privilege of traveling to the West Bank, usually at least once a year, because of the work that we were doing in Ramallah. And one time while I was there, I decided to stay for a few days outside the city of Jerusalem. And I was there outside the gates, right outside the gates of the old city. And so one day before lunch, I walked past the Garden Tomb and through the Damascus Gate. And that part of the city, at least in my experience, is one of the most crowded and noisiest places I've ever been. Street vendors and shopkeepers are constantly calling out to get your attention. Loud music blares through speakers that are not intended to play at that volume. And roaming all around the streets are young Israeli Defense Force soldiers. Young men and women, way too young to be carrying semi-automatic weapons in a crowded plaza or narrow streets. They're there to keep the peace, but in the most diverse and packed part of Jerusalem, it feels like it only adds to the threat of violence that's constantly there. And on that day, for reasons I still don't know, crowd swelled in a moment and started moving everybody along in this wave in one direction. And since I was alone, I didn't have anyone to ask what was going on, and so I was just sort of swept along with all the others until I managed to work my way through the crowd over along the walled city streets, and I finally ducked into a shop and let the crowd disperse. And then it was gone. Almost as quickly as it had formed, this crowd passed and everything returned to normal. Well, this morning we hear a story of another crowd that's formed, this time outside of Jerusalem, on the day that Jesus is working his way toward the city. And along the way, people strip palm branches from the trees and lay them at his feet, lay them in their cloaks along the road, and they wave them in celebration of his coming. Hosanna, they cry out. Save us, deliver us. But from what? From whom? Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. In this confusing and chaotic scene, I imagine it like Nate described in the call to worship. There are people there for all different kinds of reasons. All kinds of ideas and hopes and fears are filling their minds. Some of them have a deep fondness for Jesus. Some are longing for revolution. Others are just looking for a little bit of healing, or maybe some more of that free bread that Jesus has been passing out. Religious leaders are there to make sure the status quo is being kept, that he doesn't say anything too bizarre or do anything too abstract that would upset the status quo. The Roman Defense Force is there, those young Roman soldiers who are probably more terrified than the crowd because of just how chaotic it seems. And probably several had just gotten swallowed up in that sea of people and had no idea what was going on. Even the disciples were confused, as the scripture reminds us. They didn't quite understand what was going on, and it was only after Jesus was glorified that they began to understand all the things that had been written about him. And the crowd was there because of all that had happened to Lazarus. And they went out to meet him. And the religious leaders were upset, saying, look, the whole world, the whole big crowd has gone out after him. What are we going to do? Now, nobody knows exactly how many people were in Jerusalem that day on that Palm Sunday parade. Some historians suggest that as many as 2.5 million pilgrims may have come to the city during the Passover in those days. More conservative estimates put it at like 150,000. But either way, it's a whole lot of people that are descending upon this city and among those residents who made their homes in and near there. As Jesus rides into the city, it's throbbing with anticipation. It's pulsating with excitement. Because just a week or so earlier, maybe just even a few days, Lazarus had been raised from the dead. From the dead, Lazarus had been raised. The last recorded miracle before the resurrection. Now, some of us here may struggle with the miracle stories, especially this one. But I guess I've seen too many things in my life that convince me of the possibility that God is able and often willing to do things that are beyond my imagination and control. In the case of Lazarus, I don't even think it's Jesus' most improbable miracle. After all, he got a wealthy man to give half of his fortune away, which seems way more far-fetched. He got a zealot and a tax collector to call one another brothers when they had made a commitment to do each other in. All Lazarus had to do was lie there until Jesus roused him. The fact of Lazarus being alive, no matter how it happens, though, has the crowd buzzing. Some of them are giddy with excitement. Others are shocked and amazed, and a portion of the crowd is angry and threatened, because if you read just a little bit earlier in John chapter 12, the author says, "Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, who had been raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well, to kill Lazarus. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him." Something life-altering had happened to Lazarus, and he lived to tell about it. Literally and figuratively, he lived to tell about it, right? He was going to tell people because of this amazing thing that had taken place in his life. And so now his presence and his story are nearly as threatening as the Messiah's. And so the chief priests are making plans to kill him too. Now, it doesn't say how many times they were willing to kill him, because he just seemed to have this ability. But anyway, that's not part of the story. Well, as Palm Sunday sweeps us into Holy Week, I think it's a story that calls us to movement. Maybe we move toward Jesus because we sense he's our hope, that he's the one to satisfy our longing for peace and justice and forgiveness. We move toward him as the one who can save us and deliver us and set us and creation free. And though our steps may be faltering, we keep drawing closer, believing that there's healing and freedom from sin and brokenness that saddles us and the world. But I also think as we lean into this week, at least if we do so in earnest, there can be this equally strong impulse to retreat and to step back. Because grace and truth and light are unsettling. They reveal something in us and about us, this brokenness that is part of humanity. And more disturbing, our own brokenness, the brokenness that many of us try so hard to hide, those are now being seen by God. And it troubles us. Maybe this is why Meister Eckhart says that those who have the hardest time with Lent are the good people. The good people. Those of us who may agree that our lives aren't quite perfect, sure, there's probably some areas of improvement, but we absolutely, utterly resist the notion that if we're to follow Jesus, our lives must be completely turned around, turned upside down, that we must die to ourselves so that he might live through us, that God is at work and in the process of not just a tune-up, but an overhaul, and wants to make everything completely new. And so instead of moving toward Jesus, it's far easier to step back. And I imagine the crowd surrounding Jesus on Palm Sunday was actually full of a lot of good people. who came expecting him to perform some kind of revolution or some sort of miracle that would make their lives easier or at least put on some sort of religious show, rather than inviting people to actually have to make significant changes in their lives. And so they wound up retreating rather than advancing. I think that Palm Sunday and Holy Week are disorienting because our expectations about who Jesus is, that he's a humble servant rather than a conquering king, that he's leading a spiritual revolution rather than a political takeover, that he's willing to rely on the strength of love rather than the power of force to accomplish all these things, those things cause us to have to reassess how we're going to live in relationship with him and to him. I think I've said here before that one of my favorite characters in all the Bible is the crowd, because you learn so much about how people respond to Jesus by watching them, watching their reaction. But more than anything else, I think the crowd is helpful because they're us, right? That's who we are. In the scope of human history, they are largely unknown, here for a moment and gone. And so as I read the Bible, I don't usually put myself in the position of imagining myself as Peter or Mary or somebody with a name, but I sort of imagine myself in the crowd about 15 rows deep, standing behind somebody the size of Larry Hampton, who just makes it impossible to see and to hear, and I can't decide whether to elbow him in the ribs in order to get around him, to get closer, or to just give up and shrink back towards the walls of the city until all the hubbub is over. The fickle nature of the crowd, I think, gets captured perfectly in the story of the triumphal entry. On this day, there's shouts of praise and adoration that fill the air, but over the next few days, many of those same voices are going to fall silent or cast dispersion or, in fact, even call for Jesus' crucifixion. One moment we move toward, one moment we're running away. And though being in the crowd can feel overwhelming, it's also a remarkably safe place. Standing apart from the action, I can just be an admirer. I can see what's going on and think about how this wonderful rabbi is doing all these marvelous things. He teaches and tells stories that makes our hearts sing and our spirits soar. I can admire Jesus from the crowd, and I can even love him. But the funny thing is, as I read the gospel, Jesus doesn't seem much interested in admirers. He has an apparent disinterest in all that. And he calls people not to admire, but to follow. And this is the point, and it's at this point, that remaining in the crowd really becomes no longer an option. In my favorite book on preaching, Fred Craddock, who in his wonderfully creatively titled book, Preaching, says the following: Jesus will bring truth to light, and in doing so, throws all who come in contact with him into a crisis of decision. In that decision, rising and following, life and death result. Jesus precipitates the centrally important movement of one's life toward God or away from God. As much as we may wish to join the name of Jesus only to the positive, satisfying, and blessed in life, the inescapable fact is that anyone who turns on light creates shadows. And this is what is literally meant by making a difference. And it is this reality that caused many to take up the task of preaching, and I would include other forms of ministry, with great hesitation. After all, who would casually become an accessory in the radical alteration of the lives of others? I don't care if you're a prophet or a pastor or a servant or any kind of minister. In all those cases, I think if we take the gospel seriously, we're inviting people into the radical alteration of their lives. And so it puts upon us the responsibility to ask, am I willing to recognize that same responsibility? And when I call or share that invitation with others, do I do it with a sense of humility and care rather than being careless or arrogant? Because we're asking people to do something significant. When Jesus arrives in Jerusalem, everyone is for him. The world has gone after him. And the crowd is full of admirers. But Jesus is about the work of making a difference in our lives and the whole of creation. And so he puts before us the opportunity to move toward him or away. It's a question that comes in a moment in time, that important and transforming day of visitation where we're confronted by grace and we choose to receive it or not. But it also keeps coming to us each and every day, over and over again, in the daily decisions we make about how or if we're going to align ourselves with the way of Christ and the truth that's found in his kingdom. So I've been thinking about this in the days of Lent and about Holy Week this year. And I'm reminded that many of these choices really show up in the tidiness of Holy Week and how it's constructed and how the story is told. But it also, these same choices show up in the painful reality of how they confront us throughout our lives. Because when the Palm Sunday parade is over and the crowd disperses, it's going to be really easy to ease back into our comfortably numb existences. But Jesus keeps showing up. Like on Monday, when he upends the tables and he angers the religious leaders who were exploiting the poor and limiting access to God. And his actions and righteous anger inspire some people to move toward him, but most people to pull away. So on the Mondays of our lives, when Jesus calls into question our religion and overturns our tables, how are we going to respond? Or on Tuesday, as he's preaching at the Mount of Olives, and he's calling everyone who listens to radical obedience, to do more than recite spiritual platitudes or engage in religious rituals, but really to commit the totality of our lives to the work of the kingdom and care for the least of these. On the Tuesdays of our lives, when it's so much easier to close ourselves off from all that and the world, do we follow Jesus into the fray or withdraw to that place of safety and security? What about on Wednesday, where Jesus appears to be strangely absent? On the day Judas is plotting his betrayal, Jesus appears to be at rest and at prayer, trusting that God is big enough and powerful enough to hold the world together. On the Wednesdays of our lives, when Jesus calls us to stop and wait and release control of everything, will we stay with him or give in to the temptation not just to run away, but maybe to run ahead of our guide? We come to Thursday, and there's a meal. But it's more than a meal. It's an invitation to identify ourselves with him unreservedly. With the bread and the wine is the invitation to abide and obey. It gets fleshed out. It gets expressed as a call to serve one another, to wash one another's feet. He commands those around the table to love one another, to remain in unity, knowing full well there's going to be temptation after temptation after temptation to fragment. He calls them to be in the world, not of it, sanctified for God's glory rather than their own. In our day, when it seems to me every day feels like a Thursday, when we draw nearer in communion to Christ and his people, or do we withdraw? And then, before the day is through, when it looks like this is the day that brings love and fellowship and faithful community, the night brings betrayal. In the late hours of our Thursday night, when we find ourselves alone and hurt that our friends have let us down, will we stay with Jesus, determined to move toward Jesus and his willingness to forgive, to not hold another person's sins against them, or retreat in that good feeling of hurt and anger? It's Friday now, and there's a man hanging on a cross, taking the sins of the world upon himself. And he says, "Take up your cross and follow me." On the Fridays of our lives, will we enter into his sufferings? Will we move closer to him in the darkest hour, like Mary Magdalene did? Or at the first sign of conflict and threat, or that instance when we don't wish to be associated with him? And will we deny him like Peter and move back into the shadows where it's safe? Saturday. It's Saturday and God feels absent again. Jesus is nowhere to be found. He and the world have seemingly gone to hell, and darkness is all around. And though we don't know where to turn, will we trust? Can we move our feet in uncertain but resilient hope toward what we know, what we already know in our hearts is good and true? And will we keep our eyes open and our heart open for the light that will reemerge? Or have we closed them to that possibility? Sunday's coming, but that's next week. There's resurrection and celebration and new creation to embrace. Sunday in the early church was sometimes known as both the first day of the week and the eighth day of the week. First, in the sense that it begins the rhythm of our everyday ordinary lives within the world, and the eighth day because it symbolized for them the first day of the new creation, where everything was new, where the ordinary and the extraordinary come together, and we are given the choice about which of those realities is going to define our lives and our existence. In the last few minutes of worship, I wonder, and this is not a rhetorical question, this is a real question. As you think about the week ahead, whether it's related to Holy Week or your own other life, are there places of decision that you feel like you're facing or maybe struggling with that you'd be willing to share today that we could pray for you? Or other ways that you're responding to this story today? Maybe an usher will bring you a microphone if you'd like to share.